Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to our talk on the topic of the contemporary Middle East, Neo-Ottomanism and the Arab Spring, with our guest speaker, Professor Ehud Toledando. Anne and I met our speaker in Tel Aviv late last year, and he seemed to know an awful lot, so we thought when he was coming out to Australia he should come and address the Institute, which he's doing tonight. So I'll introduce Professor Toledano now. He's an author, an academic, currently Professor of Ottoman and Middle East History at Tel Aviv University in Israel. But he's had a career in the media. He appears a lot on television, radio, and in the printed press in Israel and Turkey and America and in Europe. He was on the advisory teams to former Prime Ministers Peres and Rabin. As I said, he's an author, and he's in Australia to talk to groups, to meet with the media, to brief Australian politicians and public servants. I understand our speaker will be meeting with, or has met with, or will be meeting with Mr. Hawke, Mr. Howard and Mr. Rudd. So it's a very busy itinerary. So welcome for tonight on the topic of the contemporary Middle East, Neo-Ottomanism and the Arab Spring. And our speaker will speak for about 30 minutes. We'll take 30 minutes of question and discussion and finish on the hour. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good evening. I have this wonderful gadget, which I hope works. So I'll be, moving around a bit. This is the laser stuff, so this is the the topic, this is who you are and this is who I am, but the gentleman here will have to do something about this, otherwise we won't have any show here. So, okay, I have about 29 slides, and if we stick to 1 minute per one, we should be done in 30 minutes and not disappoint Jared, right? Okay, so let's move on. We'll be talking about the following topics: this decade of change, 2002-2012. In the Middle East and North Africa, and these are the topics: the making of new Turkey from the late 1990s on, the Turkish Spring, 2007-2012. The very short Iranian Spring, we won't actually be talking much about that because it ended within 2 months and was done. And the Arab Spring, which is still unfolding over the past 14 months. Let's start with some background on Turkey, and then we will look at Turkey's developments, then its approach to the Middle East, and how the Arab Spring has turned Turkish politics and policy, foreign policy, almost 180 degrees. Okay, this is just to give you an idea. I'm sure you recognize this. And this I drew a circle around, and now you'll see why. This is the Middle East, and if I use my laser pointer, you will see. This is the Ottoman Empire, so it gives you an idea. This is the Mediterranean, it's Egypt, Syria, so on and so forth. I hope you recognize that. And if we do this, this is Australia. So you will see from the previous slide that whereas here you have 22 million people, on the same area you have in the Middle East 320 million people. So you can form an idea more or less of the proportions, and then now we also understand what we're talking about. From Ottoman Empire to Turkish Republic. The Ottoman Empire existed for 6 centuries, but it's relevant really to the Middle East only for 400 years. 400 years only, yes. From 1516 to 1918. And what we talk about is in Ottoman history, the Ottoman Empire was the epitome of diversity, because as you saw over that area, it's highly diverse, probably one of the most diverse in the world, from almost every angle. It was multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multilingual, multicultural. It was an inclusive kind of empire. You will see immediately what succeeded it. Then 1908, 1923, the Young Turks, it was, privileging the Turkish Islamic element, but encouraged integration. And this will be familiar to you because, sadly, of Gallipoli, and you're reminded of that every year in Anzac Day, this is the connection between today's Turkey and Australia, and Mr. Henderson has written about that too. So this was exclusive. The young Turks were exclusive as against the heritage of the inclusive Ottoman Empire. Kemalism. What is Kemalism? Kemalism is the ideology and practice named after Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was the founding father of the Turkish Republic. And Kemalism is the nation and national ideology of Turkey. Much as you can say that Zionism is the national movement of the Jewish people that established the State of Israel, Kemalism is the nationalist national movement of Turkey, which established and governed the Turkish Republic since its inception. Until the present day, it's the ruling ideology, but you will immediately see that it's actually falling apart. You will see how it's being replaced. And I'm talking about an impending demise. Height of Kemalism was 1923, the establishment of the Republic, until 1950. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk himself was the first president and died 1938. It was still, until 1950, a one-party political system. So it was hardly democratic. It was very aggressively secular. It was statist in its economic policies, and it was pro-Western. It was reform-minded.
Can we just step back a little bit? You're popping, so just...
Okay, so like this?
Yeah.
Is this okay? Okay, but I won't hear you now. All right. Now, you see they're objecting. You're going to have trouble with your constituency. The best thing is a sort of a moving kind of a microphone that sits up to you.
You can hear in the front row.
Okay, am I too close or what? All right. Now, what the Kemalist governments did was to suppress all the multi-elements that we mentioned before about the Ottoman Empire, and it coerced nation-building. Basically, police would be in the streets tearing off head covers from women's heads, enforcing prohibition about the call for prayers in public. The weekend became Saturday, Sunday. Friday, that is the day of prayer, was not allowed to be a special day. This was highly exclusive. It left a great part of the Turkish population without a voice in the public sphere. Erosion and reassertion happened in 1950 when they allowed a two-party system, and the opposition party of Adnan Menderes was elected. The Democratic Party had power. It had power until for a decade. In 1960, they're allowing more tolerance of Islamic manifestation finally brought the army, which regards itself as the guardian of secularism and Kemalism in Turkey, to stage a coup d'etat and do away with this government. And now we transition from the Menderes government and multi-party system to military coups. It's not the only one, it's the first, but not the only one. And political instability in the system and a series of coup d'etat, 1960, 1980, 1997. And in pictures, here is Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, another picture, and this is Adnan Menderes, and this is what they did to him in 1960. terrible, but that was what they did. Musical chairs. Now we're into a political system which is multi-party, but is problematic in terms of its stability. And you have three figures here. You have Süleyman Demirel, prime minister, president, Bülent Ecevit, prime minister several times, and Necmettin Erbakan, who was the leader of the Islamic Party at the time. So these three leaders rotated. There was never, until 1996, any religious-controlled, Islamic-controlled government. But then Erbakan managed, with only 23% of the vote, which was the size of the Islamic vote in Turkey at the time, to be prime minister, because this party split in the middle and joined his coalition. Okay. New Turkey is what we call now the current, the last 10 years of AKP government. AKP is the name of the ruling party. Their rule in Turkey has transformed it over the last 5-6 years into what is commonly known in the world as New Turkey, with a capital N. And the Turkish Spring, which I say has been lasting for about a decade and still going on strong. We have mass urbanization and a shift in the loyalty of the old elites, who were Kemalist but recognized that the system was corrupt and needed to be replaced. Build up to the 2002 elections and reassertion of religious identities. The AKP, which is the ruling party, take over in 2002, first term in office until 2007. They did not then change very much in terms of policies, but they learned a great deal. They would change in the next two terms quite dramatically. Huge economic success, rise of a new Islamic business elite, political stability, and restrictions on the military. Now, when you have a stable system and a flourishing economy, you really don't need the army to interfere. And they made a very strong case that the army should be taken out of politics. Açılım is the term in Turkish for the opening. And 2008 to the present, we have a government which is trying to open up and become much more inclusive. It's an attempt at multiculturalism, to include the Alevis. Now, the Alevis are about 25-30% of the population. Many of them are Kurdish, but this means that they are not Sunni Muslims. Kurds, of course, Christians, Armenians. So the government has tried, with this opening up policy, to negotiate a better situation so that they can really have rights culturally and in some ways also politically. This was an inclusive policy. So you see the shift on this axis of inclusion, exclusion, and now we are in a period of, we started with Ottoman inclusion, then Kemalism was exclusion, and now we're back in the age of inclusion, where the government is trying to bring all parts of society together and let them feel that they're part of a nation which is being built together. And in pictures, here you see a younger Erdogan, who is the current prime minister. This is a younger President Gül, the current president. And this is the foreign minister, Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, with David Miliband, then the British foreign minister and leader of the Labour Party, and competed for the leadership of the Labour Party to his brother and lost. Now, this is, you know, again, symbolically, you see the women wearing that, it's called turban in Turkish, and it's a headgear as a cover. And this is the İlker Başbuğ, the chief of staff, the one before last. So he is now in jail with 43 other generals on charges of conspiracy to overthrow the government. The army is completely out of politics. and here you have this as symbolism. New Turkey and the Turkish Spring. Constitutional reform stage one happened in referendum 2010. Election victory 50% in June of 2011, and we have the removal of the military from political life, and this is the Ergenekon arrests and trials that are still ongoing, and it means simply that the likelihood of another coup is very, very slim, and the army is out of politics probably for a very long time, but we really never know. Constitutional reform stage two is now in the making, and we are now in a one-year process to reach an agreed text for a referendum in 2013, which will be much more inclusive, will change the system so that it might be presidential, but we still don't know. But this is a negotiating process between all parties and all groups within Turkish society. More than 1,000 words, again, a picture. This happened in 2007, the general and the first lady. This is a receiving line in a military base where the generals and other dignitaries are standing in order to receive the president and his wife. And what happened is that you see here the second ranking general in the army leaving the receiving line, the reception, and walking away, refusing to shake the hand of the first lady because she wears the head coat. So this is one element, this is another. The general paid dearly for this because the president vetoed his promotion until last year. Finally, 4 years delay, he got the appointment that he wanted, but that was the retaliation. Okay, New Turkey's foreign policy. The architect of it is the foreign minister Ahmet Davutoglu. Here you see him in two pictures, in his office and in the ceremony, his office and a ceremony where you see Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's picture in the back. You see that in all Turkish offices, and this represents the continuation between the current government and the founding father of the republic. But as I said before and will say again, it won't take much longer before we see fewer and fewer such pictures around. Davutoglu is a professor of international relations and political science, and his theory is based on two pillars, about three, but two main pillars. One is strategic depth, which is the title of his book, 2001. That was dubbed neo-Ottomanism. I'll show you in a second why it's not. And another policy pillar, zero problems with neighbors, which Turkey wanted to follow and has to some extent succeeded, but no longer. Foreign policy is a tool in this approach for economic growth and expansion. It should actually facilitate that. Now, strategic depth and neo-Ottomanism. Is strategic depth actually neo-Ottomanism? What is strategic depth? Its geostrategic location of Turkey is with its spheres of influence in the Balkans. You'll see that on the map in a second. The Middle East and Central Asia. Use Ottoman long history in these regions, and I showed you the map before, to acquire leadership role within the Islamic world. It does not mean in any way trying to revive the Ottoman Empire. It's just using the Ottoman heritage in order to extend Turkish influence in the region. But at the same time, this meant and still means retain good ties with the US and EU through NATO. Membership in NATO continues, and seeking still EU membership despite continuous humiliation and rejection of Turkey as a member of the EU. Now, the Islamic sphere of influence, you'll see on that map, this is the where you have Muslims living throughout the world. You're closest to this. And the light green is Sunni Islam, and the dark green is Shia Islam, which you have mostly in Iran, you have it in Afghanistan, you have it in Iraq, in Yemen and in Lebanon. Here they don't show it that well, but this is it. And this is Israel, okay? This is Turkey. Now, take a look. This is one sphere of influence. That's the Balkans, previously Ottoman. The second sphere of influence is the Central Asian republics, former Soviet Union. Third area of influence is the Middle East. And here you have Turkey in the middle, and this is its strategic depth. Okay, now we move to the Ottoman heritage and see how much Neo-Ottomanism is really Neo-Ottomanism, and you see that it is not very much. The Ottoman Empire provided a system of government and law that enabled management of an empire that was multi-all, as we explained. You needed that kind of flexibility. And it was, as I said, the epitome of diversity. Also, another feature was the military being a central institution in state building and a constituent element of the governing elite. It was open to European influence and reform-minded. And it was a political culture of moderation and accommodation. Look, no Ottoman sultan or grand vizier would recognize the leaders that I've shown you before as his heirs. That's a far cry. And look at that. Albert Horani, one of the leading scholars on the Middle East in the 20th century, studied Ottoman political culture and wrote the following as he characterized the Ottoman Middle Eastern Arab and Turkish elites as patient, cautious, carefully balancing one force against another in order to neutralize them all, giving your enemy time and scope to ruin himself, seeing how far you can go, but always leaving a way of escape if you have gone too far. I was thinking it is so, you know, unfortunate that I'm going to be seeing Kevin Rudd only on Thursday. Because I could have told him something about this. Maybe this would have helped him avoid some of the embarrassment. Anyway, zero problems with neighbors. Look at that. That's the other pillar of Turkish foreign policy. And see how many neighbors Turkey has. Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine, Russia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Iran. You have Iraq. You have Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Cyprus. Now, with that, you know, you want to have zero problems with neighbors? Okay, so this is what they had to do. And they started neutralizing so many conflicts that they had in the region, and everything worked with hunky-dory before the Arab Spring that destroyed it all. So what did the Arab Spring do? And now we're going to the Arab Spring, and finally we'll finish up, hopefully in time, and bring Turkey back again and see what happened to this element of Turkish foreign policy. This is again the Middle East and the various countries in it. Each one has a different color. It's not exactly the clearest, but you know, the fact that it's, you know, with color-coded, it makes it easier. It all started in Tunisia at the beginning of 2011. And then you had Egypt erupting, you had Yemen, you had Libya, you had Bahrain in the Gulf, and you had Syria, which is still ongoing. Now, you have there, you see, I just put a circle out there in Morocco. This is different from those red stars because this is without a revolution. The king actually recognized that he needed to introduce reforms and have free elections in his country. Another similar situation is occurring in Jordan, where the king has introduced reforms again along the same lines. And in the Gulf, especially the Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, there have been similar attempts. So monarchies are trying to reform while the republics are collapsing one after the other. And now you have those countries where nothing happened during this round or during the last year. It's Iraq, which experienced a different kind of a transition under American occupation to a democratic rule, and is still, not fully completed process. You have Iran, which had a very brief spring that was brutally suppressed in 2009. You have Algeria, where nothing happened. You have the Sudan. Oh, we have the Palestinian Authority, same thing, nothing happened. And you have the Sudan. So this is the map of the Arab Spring. And we'll now move on to see an interim report of the Arab Spring. We see, we have seen, witnessed regime change in the republics of Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen. We've seen regime reform in the monarchies of Morocco, Jordan, and some of the Gulf states. And we're seeing where things are still in turmoil, that's Syria, Iraq to an extent, and no change at all in Algeria, Sudan, and KSA, which is short for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Free elections, we also know, throughout this region, that the result is clear, and we can predict that it will also happen in the other places where, like Syria, where this is not yet complete. They propel Islamic parties to power in Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, and earlier in Iraq. Likely result also in Jordan if there is regime change, in Syria if Assad goes, and in Bahrain. Okay. Now, why the differences? And we can speculate on that if you want during Q&A, but it's not clear. I at least should point out that the differences are clear and there, and they relate, they stem either from the type of regime, republic versus monarchy, or composition of society, ethno-religiously homogeneous or heterogeneous, economic situation, poor, rich, level of urbanization, youth unemployment, I have some data on this if you are interested, religion in the public sphere, tolerance of display versus suppression, maybe that has had to do something with the differences. And now we collect what we did so far, and we look at Turkey and the Arab Spring, and from zero problems, basically zero friends. Or as the president of Armenia said in a speech in Luxembourg last year, zero problems produce zero results. In short, and then we can go into detail later, if you're interested, Turkey ended up having to change its policies and do about face in at least four situations, vis-a-vis Libya, vis-a-vis Syria, Bahrain, and Egypt. And it's still ongoing. So this is a very pragmatic government which is not Islamic, not ideological, not rigid, contrary to the image it has in the West, for completely unjustifiable reasons. It is a very pragmatic government, business-oriented, and it would always privilege economic consideration over religion, for instance, in foreign relations. Turkey has no cadre of experts, think tanks, people who know the languages and the cultures of the Middle East, so it has limited regional understanding because it never cultivated such an understanding. Kemalism, if you remember that, was with its face to the Middle East and the Arabs, and with its back to the Middle East and the Arabs, and its face towards Europe and the United States. So it never thought it was important. So now Turkey is presenting itself to America as the big partner who knows everything about the region in which it is located. This is far from the truth. It might be changing and evolving, but it will take time. Capacity to change course when early assessment proves to be wrong. We just talked about that. Aggressive rhetoric, the bull in the China store syndrome, this we get from this government, and there is a very large discrepancy between what they say and what they actually do, and this is a good thing, because very often they say things that are not very pleasant to Western ears, including Israeli ears. Democracy in the Muslim in a Muslim majority country. That's Muslim majority country is a term that we use. So, is democracy possible? Obviously, we can say right now that it is, and we are hoping that it will continue, but we have no assurances. But is Turkey a model for the new Arab regimes? The Prime Minister always is being asked about this. The Turkish Prime Minister, and he says, we're not a model, but we are an inspiration. We can explain what that means later if you're interested. Now, U.S. allies, and we're very nearly done, U.S. and allies' interests. Again, only snapshots, short and middle term. The West would like to support the democratic processes, stabilize the new government, prevent economic collapse, which is imminent in a number of them, secure energy resources and markets, and prevent armed conflicts in the region while encouraging peace processes throughout. So these are the goals that now forge the foreign policies of the United States, Europe, and their allies. I think that's it.
So, many thanks to our speaker. Thanks to the Israeli Embassy for making this possible today, who's sponsoring Professor's tour of Australia. So we come to questions and discussion. I'll ask you just to speak down in the back of the room. And thanks. You're free now. You can sit up. Yeah. I think we can have this off, I think, now. Can we have that? Can someone turn that machine off? Anyone? I think there's a button up the front here. So let's go to questions and discussion. You've spoken about Turkey and the Turkish Spring, and you've spoken about the Arab Spring. You haven't been asked to speak much about the other Muslim non-Arab country in the region, which of course is Iran. So this seems to be, whatever the outcome of the Turkish Spring, or which you've indicated what you think it is, or the Arab Spring, which you've indicated you don't really know. I mean, what do you think will be the impact of the developments in Turkey and all the developments in the Arab nations on Iran?
Okay, now I don't have to look this way. So Iran obviously is a very important country in the region, and it's we've been following it for quite a while. Your question had two parts. First, how all these developments are likely to impact Iran, and the other side was Turkey versus Iran, I understand, more or less. So being in the region and facing strong opposition to the rule of the Ayatollah's regime, obviously what's happening across the Arab world and what has been happening for quite a while in Turkey raises the fears of the current regime, and they feel really the pressure and are doing everything in their ability to suppress any attempt, even small manifestations of opposition by brutal force. So just an example, Friday last, not this recent, but one before, they had held elections. In those elections, the alternatives before the voters, which turned, the turnout was very low, the figures run between 34 and 60%. In any event, it's probably not over 45%. The alternatives were very simple. Vote either for the ultra-conservatives or for the conservatives. So, and that means basically the supporters of the current president, Ahmadinejad, these are the conservatives. And the ultra-conservatives are those the supporters of the supreme spiritual leader, Ali Khamenei. The result was 75% for the ultra-conservatives and 25% for Ahmadinejad's people. So he is on the out. I mean, he's still the serving president, but he's a lame duck by all criteria. Now, the candidates that the opposition wanted to field were all disqualified by the Electoral Commission. So the opposition decided to boycott the elections. So this was no spring of any in any shape or form. What has actually happened in Iran, and people who observe it are now of the opinion, although this didn't get much traction in the press, unfortunately, that in those elections, Iran has transitioned from being a theocracy into being a theocratic Praetorian state. Why? Because Praetorian state is one controlled by a military oligarchy, and the Revolutionary Guards are now in full control. Basically, it's a military regime with very strong security organizations and police, various types of paramilitary organizations that the regime can use and actually send out to the streets to quell any attempts at an uprising or even an opposition demonstration. The question is it better or is it worse for, say, the region, for the West, for Israel? And the answer is that we really don't know, but we can speculate, and anybody's guess is as good as mine, whether generals are likely to be more reasonable and rational in their decision to use force, lethal force, and maybe risk Iran's security and well-being by courting a counterattack that could be devastating, either from the United States or from Israel, or are they likely to follow this, high, crazy rhetoric? And I don't know. My intuition is that they will be more reasonable to deal with, and actually might negotiate some sort of a freeze on nuclear, on weaponizing the nuclear, program. As for Turkey and Iran, Turkey and Iran have very good relations because it's mutual dependence in many ways. But there is competition, no doubt about that. Both are non-Arab countries with ambitions to have influence and project some sort of power, soft power. Mostly into the entire region. Not being Arab, they cannot entertain any idea of leading the region because the Arab world will be led, if at all, by an Arab country. And the only Arab country that can lead and has led the Arab world is Egypt. And true, Egypt is undergoing some severe problems right now, but it will come out of them gradually, and even if it doesn't in the present, it is already clear that the Egyptian people and the Egyptian nation, they have gained enormous prestige in the Arab world by the fact that they were willing to go out, demonstrate, and be killed by a regime that is an authoritarian, totalitarian regime, and topple the dictator who ruled them for over three centuries. So this gained for the Egyptian enormous appreciation, respect, and prestige in the Arab street, and was an inspiration for the Arab Spring in general. Turkey imports 30% of its energy from Iran, so there is dependence out there. The Iranians give the Turks an excellent deal, and credits required, and so on and so forth, and that's what the Turks, why the Turks like to trade with them. They export considerable manufactured goods into Iran. The banking systems cooperate, and this is why Turkey is finding it very hard to join decisions by the U.S. and the EU to impose stricter sanctions on Iran. But at the same time, it's probably the last thing Turkey wants is a nuclear Iran. And it does offer a model of influence and soft power leadership for the region that is quite different to the one that Iran is offering. So in that sense, they are on a collision course, but it's unlikely to be a military collision course, but rather a competition, which would be economic, would be cultural, would be political, strategic, whatever, but is unlikely to erupt into an armed conflict.
So, to question Vera.
Thank you very much. It was a very, very almost overwhelming overview of the situation. I would like to ask three aspects of it, which neither of which you mentioned too much. One is you talked about this achinim, this inclusiveness, and you actually did round up the, I guess, said the Armenians. You didn't mention the Armenian genocide. Turkey still did not recognize that, even though it was
an
Ottoman Empire. Very brief, I promise. The second question is getting into the EU, also under the inclusiveness Cyprus. And the third question, this increasing hostility against Israel.
Okay, there were questions about the Armenian massacre or genocide, the European Union and Cyprus, and the admission, and Israel.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll be also brief as much as I can. On the Armenian genocide, it's really a tragedy that the Turkish government has refused thus far to recognize it. And they will penalize as much as they can any country that does recognize that. So I was talking to Julie Bishop in Perth, and we were talking about that, and she said, you know, I told my colleagues that if you want to pass a resolution in the Australian Parliament, forget Anzac Day and Gallipoli. I mean, that'll be the least, you know, that definitely that and much more than that, you know, affect diplomatic relations and so on and so forth. France, that has recognized, along many other countries for years, the Armenian genocide, has criminalized denial of the Armenian genocide, and the Turks have, you know, withdrawn their ambassador and are, you know, reducing commercial and other relations with France substantively. So we still don't know where that is. So, There are signs, I must say, that the current Turkish government, and again, this is a positive thing, is it's running what I call a politics of apology. You know, well, they want Israel to apologize, they want Armenia to apologize, they want France to apologize, they want everybody to apologize, but they're also willing to apologize themselves. So they've now apologized for a massacre that killed 13,000 Kurds and Alevis in a place called Dersim in 1937. Now, it is gradually getting to Ataturk himself, because his daughter, the first pilot of the Turkish Air Force, flew her first mission to that area and dropped the bombs that killed quite a number of people there. Now, they say he couldn't know, he didn't know and all that, but he did accompany her to the air base and bid, you know, so waved at her when she was in the pilot's cockpit and taking off to do that terrible mission. So, yeah. There is this gradual, a bit too slow to many people's taste, of coming to terms with Turkish past, and this is Armenian issues in the one of the issues, one of the, of these items on the agenda. The EU has been dragging Turkey and humiliating it for decades now. There is a strong opposition among core European countries to Turkey joining the EU. These countries mostly are Germany, France, Austria. So, and usually when you have right-wing governments in the Latin countries of Italy, Spain, France, Portugal, you also have opposition there. Britain is really the only strong supporter of Turkey in that process. And it is right now unlikely to proceed because of various reasons. Turkey is a member of NATO and will continue to be. So Turks are you know, very offended by this, but nevertheless have not withdrawn their application. And if offered membership, they will immediately respond positively and join. But now, you know, in terms of the rhetoric that I talked about before, so now they're saying, you know, who are these Europeans? You know, why should we join them? Look at the euro, it's collapsing. And look at our economy, we are booming. So why should we join? To rescue them? Forget about it. So, I mean, that's as serious as you can imagine. And the last question was about Israel and Turkey. And of course, this is a very sad story. An alliance, an axis of alliance between the two countries that was one of the main elements of Middle East stability for decades, is now collapsed completely. Now, in terms of the, as I pointed out before, the pragmatism of the Turkish government and its ability to change course 180 degrees when it discovers that it was wrong at some, and that its interests are going to hurt, there's one exception. This. you know, the relationship with Israel. And it's not 100% clear to me or other observers why this is so. There are clear common interests between Israel and Turkey in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East in general, although growing circles within the political elite in Ankara and Istanbul recognize it. The Prime Minister is too emotionally invested in this, and so is the foreign minister, and they find it very hard to actually make the change and get off this tree that they have gone on, demanding full apology, full compensations for the flotilla incident, and the removal of the Gaza blockade, which was an added condition later. This is unlikely to come from the Israeli side, which also lost the appetite for making any concessions to Turkey. And there's, great anger in government circles and in the public about Turkey's behavior. But there is gradual reduction of the level of the rhetoric on the Turkish side. The Israeli side does not respond. Prime Minister, contrary to my suggestion and recommendation, will not respond. And I think he's sort of leaving the Turkish media scene completely to one side that bashes Israel all the time. And anything he would say or anybody else, you know, in government would get immediately broadcast on Turkish media and enormous attention. That's all I can do. What I did do is write two articles. I gave an interview on a leading Turkish journal, Milliyet, on this, and wrote an article, an op-ed article in two newspapers. But just to give you an idea, the title of one of them was, "Is Israel Trembling and on Its Knees, or Is Ankara Dreaming?" And of course my answer is Ankara is dreaming, but the trembling and on its knees was in response to the kind of rhetoric that you hear from Prime Minister and Foreign Minister that is totally unhelpful and has nothing to do with reality. After all, with respect to Turkey's power, it is not the most powerful country in the Middle East, neither economically nor militarily. So, but this is a sad element, especially for people like me who love Turkey and go there and have friends there and colleagues and work with Turkey all the time. So this is a problem. I hope it will be resolved, and we're trying to do something in the background to make this possible, but the results are few and slow in coming.
Question there, and then one here.
Yes, the Middle East problem, or the Arab Spring, looks to me like a whole lot of unemployed people jumping up and down. I wonder if they do get what they want. You see an economic development in the Middle East, especially as most of the great oil producers are now looking everywhere in the world to get oil.
The question is there an economic solution to the Middle East, and that some of the demonstrations, the suggestion is, have come out of the high levels of unemployment?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one of the things that I didn't show, but one of the things economists usually bring up is the youth bulge, where you have, you know, very large young populations between the ages of 15 and 30, and unemployment between 15 and 24 is one of the major criteria to examine the actual well-being of an economy. And in this region, it's very, very high. But I would be reluctant, because I haven't been able to find the correlations, to attribute something. Okay, because I'm getting sort of background music there, and I'm not a singer, so. But to try and explain the Arab Spring by economic factors, this is far from being the case. There's a strong desire of freedom by people who have been oppressed for so many years, and their lives were, you know, hell. But nevertheless, these economies, and this is one of the good things that come out, and I've been telling my Israeli colleagues and other people, you know, who are interested in a peaceful Middle East, I'm saying that regardless of the rhetoric that we're not going to like coming out of those newly elected Islamic governments, it will be a lot of anti-Americanism, anti-Europeanism, and anti-Israel. Nevertheless, their capacity, of all these countries, to actually do something, anything, externally, aggressively against Israel or Western targets has been degraded so severely that it's really no longer on the table as an option. And if you talk to these people, I mean, they tell you, I talk to leaders of Islamic parties, and they will tell you, look, I mean, we may not like the current situation. We may like to revise the peace treaty through direct negotiations with Israel, but there's no question, it's not on the table going back to the days of the wars, not only because we don't want that, but because we're totally incapable of doing anything, since we need all the energies to build our own societies. They need that to build economies that are in a shambles, negotiate a political system that will be viable and acceptable, and change constitutions, rework the relationships in each country between the major elements in the elite and in society, which are the military, the security and police organizations, the judiciary, the media, and the political parties. I mean, to forge that new alliance, which is, you know, a sine qua non for any country, any state to function properly, takes enormous energies. And we really don't know when this will be resolved. It may take years. And while this is taking years, two things will happen. A, they'll be able to do nothing militarily outside. Yes, you know, maybe they will not be as effective in preventing low-intensity guerrilla operations, terrorist attacks, here and there, now and then. Maybe, maybe not. It's not, but it's not something that Israel or its allies cannot deal with. And the other good thing is that their needs for economic aid and development and know-how and expertise are going to be so enormous that Greece would look like paradise.
Okay, we've got to be quick. There's a question here. Yeah.
My understanding is that the people under about 30 represents 50% of the population of Iran, and the majority of these people are not very keen on their own government. So what's stopping them from rebelling in the same way as Egypt and Libya and Syria?
They've tried it.
So what's stopping them from starting again?
They realize that...
The question is, what's stopping the young people of Iran from uprising, taking part in an uprising as they did in Egypt? Yeah,
right, that's correct. What's stopping them mostly is fear of the regime's suppression and suppressive actions. This regime, like very much the Assad regime, by the way, I mean, they're watching what's happening in the next door, crossover from Iraq, and you look at Syria, thus far 8,000 people killed. Enormous bloodshed, enormous cruelty, and these, as you said, they're educated young people who oppose the regime and have tried it once and failed. So it really is a question whether they will try it again soon, and if they do, they will try to do it in the best circumstances possible right now, because there is this waiting game to see what will happen with the nuclear program, whether the United States or Israel, either or both, will attack and see. So that gives them a few months ahead of time to see how this pans out. And if the regime is weakened because of something like this, which is a possibility at least, then they might take advantage of this and then act. But even then, you know, I would say that it will take much more than what it took in the Arab countries.
There's a question here. Yeah.
When they're starting from scratch and drawing up a new constitution, which way are they going generally, parliamentary or presidential, and which way should they go?
Okay, they're going both, by the way. I mean, because let's take a country like Egypt, let's take Tunisia. These are parliamentary systems with a strong prime minister, but the stronger figure is the president. So what you have had in Egypt and in Tunisia, in Egypt you had elections, you know, to parliament, phased, and you know, the lower house and the upper house, and it's regional, it's district. It was a very complicated system. That voting and counting took over a month. So you can imagine what this is, but it was fair and free elections by any standards of observers from abroad. Presidential elections have not yet taken place in Egypt, and they will take place probably in July. This is what is being promised right now. But there is, uncertainty about this. And, of course, again, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. And we will have to wait and see how this happens. There's a big discussion whether to have the constitution written, drawn, and approved before the elections or after. And there were different groups of interests pushing for each position. And this went on, and ultimately they had the elections before the constitution was finalized. And now it's the big debate of what role the army will have, whether parliament will have supervision over the budget of the army, and so on and so forth. And these are crucial questions that need to be worked out. In Tunisia, for instance, while the Islamists won the parliament, the parliamentary elections, they offered to an opposition group that ran against them and lost to actually nominate the president. And they did. So now they're trying to work in cooperation. But again, this is a project in building and a website under construction. This is
just a final question. You've spoken about the relationship between the Turkish Prime Minister and President and the current government in Jerusalem. But what about at the personal level that you deal at? You mentioned you travel to Turkey. I mean, how do you get on with fellow academics, people in the media? Is there a different kind of engagement at that level?
Totally different. I mean, there's growing and very intense interest in actually maintaining the relationships that we have managed to build before, because the idea is that when governments fail to deal with each other, it's civil society organizations and institutions that need to step in and maintain some sense of reason, so that, you know, when and if those governments find a way to reconcile with each other, there is something to go back to rather than a whole parking lot of relationships. And to give you an example, Tel Aviv University has a fund that's named after one of the men on the picture, President Demirel, pictures we had before, and in which which funds student exchanges, programs, conferences, and things like that. And it's funded by the Turkish government under the Ministry of Culture. During the flotilla incident, it was suspended for 6 weeks, then renewed, and the payments are still going on. And it is basically the Turkish government, current government, which says terrible things about Israel, funding academic exchanges. As, you know, the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of the Economy, Ali Babacan, boasted, and then, you know, I was reminded that he was not supposed to boast about this, that trade with Israel has increased by 30% over the last 6 months, which is one of the highest in the... So he listed, he stands up, a very intelligent person, by the way, very pro-American and highly educated, stands and lists the 10 top countries with which trade has been increasing, and Israel is out there on third place. And then why don't you take the slide off the screen? So
we'll take you off the platform now. So... So when Anne and I met Professor Tale Dando in Tel Aviv, we were very aware that he was an expert on the Ottoman Empire, and as you know, Australia had an involvement in the fall of the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. So we thought we'd get him to talk about what's going on in Turkey, as well as the Arab Spring, in relation to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which he's done in an extremely coherent manner, because there's a lot of history involved in the century or so since the First World War, and he went beyond that, before that. So what we had today is a very balanced and rounded discussion. Not too many predictions about the future, because, as you know, we don't know much about the future, if we know anything about the future. But a lot of contemporary analysis and important reflections on the past. So congratulations for a fine speech tonight. We'll have the talk up on our podcast tomorrow. Anne will publish it in the Sydney Papers online in due course. APAC is here. And they're always welcome. And so for tonight, many thanks and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.